Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, climate scientist James G. Anderson. And not all of the news is bad. I hope you'll stay tuned. In a few weeks, New World Notes will be 8 years old. I'm as surprised as anybody at our endurance. One thing that's helped considerably is my discovery that I am far from alone in this. By this, I mean producing audio programs and giving them away in the attempt to make some small difference in the world. Over the years, I've found a handful of people who have been recording high-quality, thoughtful speeches and interviews with a progressive perspective like my own. The producers have shared these recordings, and some of them have ended up broadcast on New World Notes, perhaps with a bit of editing and condensing by yours truly. That includes this week's program, part one of an interview with climate scientist James G. Anderson. Now, there are some fine, established producers that have made big contributions to alternative radio. For instance, David Barsamian, Mariah Gillardin, Alex Smith, and Lynn Gurry, now retired. These are my role models, so to speak. But I'd like to single out some people who are much less well-known. Little guys, so to speak, out in the field, doing very good work, pro bono. That list includes Robin Upton, who took over unwelcome guests when Lynn Gurry retired. Robin lives in Bangladesh, of all places. A little closer to home, in Seattle, are Ed Mays and also Mike McCormick. In Boston, Chuck Rosina has recorded many fine talks and the occasional concert. In upstate New York, Wilton Vaught has made very good recordings for local public access TV. From time to time, New World Notes has adapted and broadcast material recorded and shared by all of these people. Many thanks to them, and to one more, Dale Lehman in Chicago, who interviewed climate scientist James G. Anderson. Anderson works at Harvard, but found himself in Chicago about a year ago. Dale was quick to pounce and got a very interesting interview. We'll hear it this week and next. In this week's segment, Anderson explains why global warming is a bad term. For one, it radically understates the climate change calamity that is now underway. He then makes short work of the trumped-up argument that climate change is natural, not man-made. He has interesting things to say also about the ozone layer, the Kyoto Protocol, and why electricity is overwhelmingly the best fuel. Best for transportation and, surprisingly, best for heating, too. It's fascinating stuff. Anderson is a model of clarity and obviously a pretty knowledgeable guy. Speaking with Dale Lehman, here is James G. Anderson.
I'd like to ask, how would you define climate change?
How would I define climate change?
Yeah.
Well, I think the most important way to look at climate change is to look at the structure that defines the overall dynamics of the atmosphere and how that couples into a combination of weather, severe storms, changes in the ice structures, shifts in the temperature difference between the tropics and the polar regions. So the climate is set up as a feedback structure that is highly coupled, so that changes in one part, for example, loss of Arctic ice, cascades into a whole array of different fundamental changes in the structure of climate. For example, right now the current climate structure is built around a very cold polar region and a very warm tropics. And because of that, we have a very, very dry stratosphere. And that's a unique climate structure. If we lose Arctic ice and the temperature difference starts to decrease between the tropics and the polar regions, the overturning structure of the atmosphere will relax and water will enter the stratosphere. We'll have a very wet stratosphere, and the result of that is that the temperature difference between the equator and the pole will essentially vanish. And that completely changes the way the climate structure of the Earth behaves. But more than that, with a moist stratosphere, ozone is removed from the stratosphere because we have chlorine and bromine that are present there because of CFC release. And so that's going to be profoundly damaging to life on the surface, not just human beings, but also all of our staple crops that provide food for the population. All of that will collapse. So I view climate as an issue of the structure, not simply a matter of global warming. I think the term global warming is a very inappropriate description. It carries with it the connotation of very slow change and the fact that we can think things over. But instead of that, the climate is a series of irreversible steps. The time constant for change is set by these feedbacks. And so it's a very delicate, very intricate structure that we've been bequeathed by the optimal relationship between the cold polar region and the warm tropics.
We've always had these debates, right, regarding climate change is caused by humans or is it caused by nature, but where do you stand on this matter?
Well, when you look at the changes in climate over the past millions of years, it's very evident that there were mechanisms in place that caused those natural changes, whether it was a volcanic emission of CO2, whether it was the removal of CO2 from the atmosphere by the carbonate silicate reactions, or whether it was the Earth's orbit eccentricity and the tilt of the Earth in combination that carried us in and out of glacial periods for the past 2.5 million years. When you look at these patterns, they are all overwhelmed by increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's a very simple calculation. And so the idea that what we've seen recently is a natural process decoupled from human activity is simply false. Humans are overwhelmingly responsible for causing the forcing of the climate that's now taking place that slowly manifests itself in average global temperature change, but dramatically emphasizes the point that the delicacy of the climate structure revolves first around the removal of ice structures, particularly in the Arctic. And so there's no question that human beings are fundamentally responsible for the current changes in the climate.
Do you think climate change is drastically affecting you?
Well, it's drastically affecting me in that I study it, and my concern grows year by year as I study the system more and more carefully and study the feedbacks that lead to tipping points, which are irreversible changes. So it has a huge impact on my life. With respect to my analysis of personal impacts by climate change alone, part of our research focuses on the intensity and frequency of severe storms in the high plains of the United States in the summer. These are tornadoes, hail storms that we tend to take for granted in this country, but are in fact unique worldwide. And the reason that these storms are important, first of all, is of course they are profoundly destructive to human life and human property. But more importantly, they're capable of injecting water directly into the stratosphere over the United States in the summer. And we diagnosed the chemistry over the Antarctic in the Arctic in the winter that led to the Antarctic ozone hole and then comparable large removal of ozone over the Arctic in the late winter. And diagnosing that chemistry, we realized that it's exactly the same chemistry that's triggered by storms injecting water vapor into the stratosphere, except in this case it's over the United States in the summer rather than the polar regions in the winter. So, absolutely. Now, of course, the jet stream position is a sensitive function of the temperature difference between the tropics and the polar regions, and that jet stream position, of course, brought one of the largest snowfalls to New England. So, yeah, I shoveled out day after day after day, and if we had a disciplined temperature structure between the tropics and the polar regions, the meandering of that jet stream would not have occurred the way it did. So, yes.
We know that many institutions these days spend so much money on trying to combat global warming. There are many non-profit organizations, but do you think the money being spent is actually making a difference? Because we see that global warming is still a very big issue.
Okay, first of all, of course, based on what I've said so far, the term global warming is an inappropriate term to describe climate change. And I think one of the reasons that the entire campaign around climate change has been ineffective was that, and scientists are at fault for this, the term global warming was used, and it carries with it no political imperative, because many people want their backyard to be warmer. They're moving out of New England and the northern Midwest and moving south. So it has no political impetus behind it, and it has this connotation of slow change. So if I compare the resources going into describing climate change and its irreversible consequences versus the money that's going in from the fossil fuel industry distributing misinformation about this subject, there's no parity between those two. Massively more money is being spent on misinformation from the fossil fuel industry than is being spent on representing the facts related to climate change. Now, I also hold universities culpable because they're not educating their undergraduates on the fundamentals of what's actually occurring in the climate energy axis. And until universities step up and take responsibility for modern curricula that prepare their graduates to take a proactive role in society, it's going to be very difficult to make political progress, because the money invested in by the fossil fuel industry and misinformation largely overwhelms efforts to try to explain this to the public.
Do you think climate change is now more to a political issue or a scientific issue?
Yeah, well, it's overwhelmingly an issue of political will, but you're absolutely correct in bringing in three elements of this: politics, science, and economics. And as the situation is examined more and more carefully, it's pretty clear that economics is switching strongly over for renewable energy, because, to put it bluntly, middle-aged and older people are making money off of fossil fuels, and that blocks opportunity for young people to engage in innovation, creativity, and economic enterprise globally. But the investment in renewables and the job opportunities presented by renewable energy vastly overwhelm the job opportunities in fossil fuels. And in fact, you can see it occurring. There are major investments by companies. Google, for example, is just one, but many others, investing in renewable energy and renewable energy infrastructure. And the country that wins this battle on innovation and development of renewable energy sources, wind, solar, geothermal, that become economically competitive worldwide, will be the country or countries that win the economic battle, because there's vastly greater opportunity and capability for the next generation embedded in the renewable energy sector than there is in fossil fuels. Fossil fuels is a dead industry. It doesn't generate jobs in anything close to the number of the potential within the renewable energy industry.
Are you familiar with the Kyoto Protocol?
Oh, yes.
Do you think it would actually be beneficial for U.S. if it actually joined the Kyoto Protocol? Because it did withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol, right?
Right. Well, starting with another protocol, we did the key research over the Antarctic demonstrating that CFCs destroyed ozone, in particular the chlorine and bromine radicals. And so we were involved in the public policy debates around the Montreal Protocol, which then became an international agreement banning CFCs. So I've watched the evolution of these protocols very carefully. The Kyoto Protocol had on its side the advantage that it brought nations together to try to execute an international agreement on fossil fuels. Now, it failed in many ways. One of them was that it probably didn't recognize the rapid ascent of the Asian economic structure. And secondly, you can watch very carefully to see whether there'll be any serious negotiation over carbon release, namely CO2 and methane, by whether nations actually have a highly unequivocal budget of their own carbon release and take up, because all of these countries are very, very different. The United States, for example, because it was an agricultural endeavor on the eastern end of the United States in the 19th and early 20th century, it actually was taking up quite a bit of carbon because it was regrowing these forests that were cleared for farming. But every nation is different, and every nation has to have a very detailed definition of the flux of carbon into and out of its own territory. So the Kyoto Protocol didn't have that basic information in place, so it couldn't in any way be an effective international governance. On the other hand, it opened the debate about nations signing on to carbon control. So from that point of view, it was a landmark event. It just had some fatal flaws in it, which could have been repaired in time had countries stepped in to take advantage of it. And that gets back to the fundamental point. Until China, the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and Korea, and perhaps Brazil, sign on to a carbon control agreement, it won't take place. So, you know, meetings involving 190 nations are simply never going to solve the problem. It has to be solved with China and the United States signing an agreement, having clear controls, and then Western Europe, Korea, and Japan signing on to those agreements.
There has been theories regarding why climate change has happened. For example, like that there's a change in the ozone layer. Do you think that it really a big factor, the change in the ozone layer, in terms of how the climate is changing?
No, the ozone layer doesn't control climate. Climate controls the ozone layer. It works the other way around. The ozone controls this lethal small segment of the spectrum, the ultraviolet spectrum, which just barely penetrates the stratospheric ozone, because ozone is the only molecule that removes ultraviolet photons between 200 and 300 nanometers, which is exactly where DNA absorbs ultraviolet photons. And an ultraviolet photon absorbed by DNA breaks the base pair across the double helix and it initiates cancer. So ozone is extremely rare. If you compress the total ozone column from the stratosphere to the floor of this office, it would only be an eighth of an inch thick. So tiny, tiny amount of ozone. It has dominant control, total control over that crucial segment of the ultraviolet spectrum that kills organisms on the surface and initiates cancer. But ozone doesn't control the climate. On the other hand, climate intimately controls ozone, because climate controls the amount of water going into the stratosphere and the amount of water in the stratosphere at decidedly controls the ozone concentration.
Why do you think humans have failed to actually, like, curb the greenhouse gases to control them?
Oh, because the entire economic infrastructure is built on the back of cheap energy, namely fossil fuels. And fossil fuels are abundant, they're very inexpensive, and yet they are responsible for 85% of all primary energy generation worldwide. So we've built fossil fuels into our economic structure. However, I think Mother Nature is sitting back and watching this process, saying, well, I gave humans the intelligence to know how to extract an amount of fossil fuels to initiate the Industrial Revolution, but I've also given human beings 10,000 times as much energy per unit time from the sun as is required to sustain all of human endeavor. So now I'm going to see whether humans are smart enough to convert from fossil fuel to renewable energy, because I've given them all the renewable energy they could possibly hope for. And so it's going to be a question of political will and fundamental intelligence about whether we can break the back of a needless economic infrastructure based on fossil fuels that not only causes climate change, but the release of nitrate, sulfate, heavy metal from coal combustion in particular is extremely toxic. I mean, look at China today, look at the United States 30 years ago. Nitrate sulfate emission is a catastrophic contribution to acidity in the atmosphere and damages lakes, human lungs, and then mercury that's interstitial to coal is very damaging to the human nervous system. So everything is wrong with burning fossil fuels. Everything is correct in converting photons from the sun to electricity. And that leaves you with only 7% of the requirement for liquid fuels, and we can create all the liquid fuel we need for aviation from biomass. So nature set this whole system up ideally for us. The question is, are we smart enough to figure this out?
Do you think that humans can switch to renewable energy in the near future, though? Because people do have some technology, such as solar-powered cars, but the when they do try to invent that, they later on found out that it would quite be costly to be used in the near future.
Automobiles, are you talking about?
For example, automobiles, yeah.
Okay, let's take an automobile. I drive an electric car, for example, and the first thing you discover when you drive an electric car is that they're profoundly better systems than a gasoline-powered automobile. They are quiet, they accelerate very, very quickly, they're very agile, they're very simple to drive, and it costs you, typically for a standard gasoline-powered car, it costs you about $2,500 a year for the average driving distance to fuel that car for a year. It costs you $250 for the electricity to go the same distance. So immediately, if humans test electric cars, they're going to switch over to them. Now, it's true the technology for the range of the electric car is evolving. The Tesla Model S, for example, goes 280 miles on a charge. The particular car I drive goes about 100 miles on a charge, but it has a range extender for another 80 miles or so. So the cost is actually far less to propel the system through electricity than it is through buying gasoline. And the same is true of heating and cooling buildings. A heat pump is more than twice as efficient as burning fossil fuels in your basement to heat your house, because the heat pump uses the intrinsic heat or energy in an air mass and only adds a small amount of that to warm your house. And this can be done thermodynamically very, very efficiently. So when you look at the laws of thermodynamics, you see that electricity, heat pumps, electric motors, are vastly more efficient and less expensive than heat engines. heat engines, for example, in your car only convert about 12 to 13% of the chemical energy in gasoline into motive force. So if you look at the laws of physics and you look at the economic pathways forward, you see that electrification of these systems is by far the most efficient, cost-effective way. And that doesn't include all the damage done to the environment and to climate by the effluents coming from fossil fuel combustion.
1, 2, 3, 4. First you have to have a problem. That part isn't hard. The second step is everybody realizing they're like you. They're holding the same card. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change. So quick. The congressmen and businessmen and TV sets will try hard to make sure it isn't so. You don't have a problem. If you do, it's not the same problem. And if it is, well, there's just nowhere you can go. But that many times, the history is rich, though we easily forget how a meme can take hold and grab you, how it can spread out like a net, and everything can change. So quick. They'll say we are lost or we're dreaming, or they'll make a dream for us. They'll try to come up with a good story about why we belong at the back of the bus, about why we belong in this position, about how we don't know what we meant, about how there most certainly isn't any such thing as the 99%, but everything can change. Everything can change so quick.
Followed James Anderson's mildly optimistic talk with a mildly optimistic song by David Rovix. Thanks to both, and thanks to Dale Lehman for the recording, which I have gently edited. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. You'll find a free archive of our shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising, illegitimi non carborundum, try to live each day as though the truth were true, and please come back again for part two of the Anderson interview and more next week. Ciao.